Morning. For those of you who are way back there, there are some seats in here, in the other room, if you'd like to come in here. One person. Come on in. Make yourself comfortable. So this morning I'm going to talk about moving through fear and liberating happiness. Oh boy. what we call our Buddha nature. That's happiness. Our still nature, our open nature. That's happiness. So how do we move through fear and liberate that happiness that's right here? It's right here. Well, we do seem to live in a fear-based culture these days. Not too many people would argue that we don't. And a lot of us internally, we operate from a fear-based feeling. And it seems like our culture has become more fear-based the last year or two. And, of course, we're not immune to that. So if our culture is more fear-based, we tend to be more fear-based. So how do we practice with this? How do we work with this? How do we live with this? Well, first of all, what do we tend to do when we're our basis is fear, or our culture is fear-based? I think there are three things. I'm gonna stop talking while these two women find seats, and they could always come in here. There are lots of seats in here.
She's scared.
It is. You're the scary one, not me. Hi. Or maybe I'm the scary one, not you. Or maybe we're both the scary ones, or maybe neither of us are the scary ones in this fear-based culture. So, we do three things. One, sometimes we become more compliant, more willing to surrender our rights for vague promises of safety. That's one thing we do. A second thing is we withdraw more, especially if it's the culture. We withdraw more into our own immediate tribe. You guys are my tribe. And, you know, I've only been here, 45 years, but I'm a Californian, not a Minnesotan. That's my tribe. We take care of the environment. We welcome immigrants. That's my tribe. I mean, not the Minnesotans don't, too, but our governor, Jerry Brown, he's a Zen guy, and he's trying to do deals with Europe to support environmental initiatives. And so anyway, we do that. We do that. We withdraw into our tribe. And if it's internal, if the fear is internally based, then we often go into hopelessness. We just go into hopelessness. We just sort of give up. And we lose our energy. We become kind of listless. And a third thing we do is we become more security-oriented, less open to new possibilities. We see the future through the lens of fear or hopelessness. And this lens distorts things. I was recently in a very warm place for quite a few weeks. I only Googled Trump or Trump Russia twice in 28 days. Breaking my habit of doing it daily, at least once daily, saying to myself, well, I'm only doing it for 5 minutes, or 10 minutes, or 15 minutes, you know. So when I do that, when I encourage that distortion by just doing that, I'm focusing on the negative. I'm exaggerating the potentially threatening, and I'm filtering out alternative views. And then what do we end up doing? Often we end up compromising our core values out of the urgent need to survive. And survival is what human beings want to do. We're animals. We want to survive. So we compromise our core values to survive. But fear not named narrows our vision. Such shuts down our intuitive capacity, as well as the ability to be reflective. And in a way, it promotes violence. So the courage to name, I'm anxious, I'm afraid. I've been sitting for 13 years, twice a day, and I'm just frightened. The courage to name it and to share it. Name it for yourself and share it. That's the beginning of depotentiating it. Depotentiating it. If our life energy gets lost to fear, to worry, our body braces and our heart closes. Our body braces and our heart closes. So we want to find a way not to be consumed. Not to be consumed. We want to, as practitioners, move through dukkha to sukha. Move through suffering to happiness. To happiness. Which is really what the Buddha's path is about. We'd like to just jump over suffering, jump over fear, get right to happiness. But we have to move through it. We have to observe the internal and external culture of fear in a non-judgmental, as much as possible, open-hearted way. How does it impact us? How are we reacting? Is there stuff from our childhood that's getting evoked? Often. Very often. And as we deepen our sitting, sometimes we experience more fear. Fear has come up, especially if you do retreat. I know there was a one-day retreat here yesterday. A one-day retreat, a two-day retreat, a seven-day retreat. Stuff comes up that you don't even know you have, that you think is all gone. But that's part of the process of opening up in a non-judgmental, accepting way. Being alert and letting curiosity be your teacher. Curiouser and curiouser, cried Alice in Wonderland as she saw her body grow to be huge. Curiouser and curiouser, cried Alice. So I had a student, Wendy, years ago. She sat a lot with me. And she had the courage to see the depth and the breadth of the fear within. Curiouser and curiouser, I said to Wendy, trying to lighten it up a little bit. And then finally she got it. Curiouser and curiouser, non-judgmentally, open-heartedly. Here it's coming up. Here it's coming up. A lot of stuff in there. A lot of stuff. So sometimes fear is an accurate perception. Well, I should be scared of the rabid dog outside who's foaming at the mouth. I should be cautious about going outside. That's an accurate perception. Sometimes fear is totally distorted perception. And usually if you feel things are hopeless, your distortion has become so extreme that you've just tamped everything down. And usually that means that childhood or adolescent stuff has come in to tamp everything down, to protect you. But not in a very healthy way. Not in a very healthy way. So can we be curious to whatever comes up and not treat it as an absolute truth? It's here in this moment. But are you sure it's going to be here in the next moment? Are you absolutely sure? Didn't Buddha say something about transiency? So I'd like to suggest that there's a spectrum of fearful experiences. First, apprehension or anxious agitation about something coming up. Like the dog. I don't know why I chose a rabid dog. I've never even seen a rabid dog. I love dogs. But anyway, there is a rabid dog out there. And, you know, I have some apprehension or anxious agitation. So I want to pay attention to that. I don't want to be bit by that dog. I want to go out the front way or get a couple of dog biscuits or something. Right? So I have been giving talks in this room off and on, but mostly on, since, I don't know, something like 1978. And I can remember when I was asked to give my first talk, maybe it was even earlier than that, I was apprehensive and anxiously agitated. Apprehensive and anxiously agitated. And that's natural, isn't it? If something is unfamiliar to you, you're exposing yourself to be with other people to show your dharma, and you think, God, my dharma is just a mess. I got to show my mess to these people. So that's natural. And I rehearsed, and in those days, I rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed. I rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed. And that was how I did it. And then later, I didn't have to do it so much. And now, that's pretty cool. So, apprehension or anxious agitation. Second one, full-blown fear. Far more stringent response from the nervous system. If the fear, and there's a chance to practice, bare awareness and curiosity. Huh, what's going on here? Huh, can I just open my heart, open my psyche to it? Just watch it, not judge it. But even then, sometimes my practice is not. I forget to practice, especially because I'm afraid. afraid. So then it goes into third level, anxiety or panic attack. Lots of people I've worked with over the years, more at Zen Center than as a therapist, have had anxiety or panic attacks. It's nothing to be sort of ashamed of. It happens. It doesn't matter. You could be sick for 20 years and it might happen to you. It happens. Or, on the other hand, loss of energy. And when there's a loss of energy, usually there's a hopelessness that goes with it. Usually there's just a blah. Everything is gray. Not only is outside gray, everything is gray. Even if you go to Florida in the winter, everything is gray. So we get swept into panic, or we collapse into depression, or we desperately try to distract ourselves. But through the practice of bare awareness, kind, open awareness, and curiouser and curiouser, said Alice, we can just be with it. Just be with it and let it just dissipate on its own. Let it just dissipate on its own. We have to have some trust that it will dissipate. Well, that's why you work with a teacher. That's why you work with a teacher to help you. I love meeting one-to-one with people, and so do the other teachers here. And I'd love to meet with more of you more often one-to-one. I don't think I'm that scary. Just sign up. Call the office or tell me you'd like to meet with me. So we're developing tolerance for the unpleasantness of uncertainty. uncertainty is unpleasant. This external culture, is this going to continue? Are we going to be this divided? Is this the beginning of the end for democracy as it was created and as we know it? We don't know. We don't know. But here it is. Here it is. And through our bare awareness and our curiosity, we can tap into our Buddha nature, our still nature, our open nature. So the psychologist Philip Moffat, Buddhist psychologist, there are a lot of Buddhist psychologists these days. The Buddhist psychologist Philip Moffat suggests there are four levels of alertness. First of all, there's a normal state of alertness you experience when you're walking down the street, when you're driving in your car, when you're washing the dishes. Secondly, there's a level of alertness when you suddenly perceive a possible danger. The body-mind switches to more extreme alertness, vigilance. And that's natural and healthy because I don't want the rabid dog to get me, so I need to be alert. Even if I go out the front door and come around the back, he's still going to be there, so I need to be alert. I need to be alert. But the vigilance ends once the danger passes. But the third kind of alertness is that when there is a prolonged sense of anxiety or fear, we become hypervigilant, ready to fight, flight, or flee or freeze. And, you know, each of us have different modalities that we tend to fall into until the trauma passes. And we get a tunnel vision in which in this tunnel, mostly we experience everything through the lens of fear and anxiety. And it can become a pattern. Also, again, roots and stuff from the past, or from working in a hostile situation, or from being in a relationship which is abusive. And some people might say that our society right now is in the hypervigilant stage. Some people would say that. So we need to really be careful, because if we fall into this hypervigilant stage ourselves, because our culture is, then we can't be bodhisattvas, then we can't help anyone, and we can't help anyone. And the fourth type of alertness is response to fear, which is frozen traumatic reflex that occurs when danger is continuous or your nervous system loses the ability to perceive that the danger has passed. You're thwarted in your effort to fight or flee, and you're locked into a pattern. So I'm going to call this guy Jethro that I used to meet with. I used to meet with a guy, Jethro, who many years ago, I supported him in his practice when I was a young priest. Jethro was about 6'6", or I don't know, 6'7", I don't know. He was really tall and very, very thin and very, very quiet, and came to Zazen here, came to sit here in the morning. Not many people do come every day, but he did for quite a while. And then began seeing me one-to-one. Then I thought he really had his act together. Of course, he did have his act together. He was very polite. But he began to, as I began to get to know him, and he talked about his Zazen, I realized that he was continually living in a frozen, fear-based state. As some really tall people do, he hunched his shoulders a little bit, just a little bit. And he said to me one day that he learned to do that as a kid to avoid attracting attention to himself, because the other kids teased him and, you know, made fun of him and called him all kinds of names, stick man and all those things. Probably much worse names than that, I don't know. So he learned to do this to protect himself from the verbal blows. I don't think physical blows, I don't know, verbal blows. Frozen shoulders. And Katagiri Roshi was the head teacher then, and he would come around and try to try to help him with his shoulders, but his shoulders were like this. Try to, we would do even put his hand on his shoulders to try to help him. But through his bare awareness and his curiosity, he began to notice and be curious about this kind of frozen area in his body. His sensations of tightness, of unease, even of numbness, and began to let the fear, began to recognize the fear that he didn't even know about that was underneath, to recognize it, until he eventually unwound, little by little, little by little. And then one day he smiled. And I never realized that I had never seen him smile. And he didn't seem like the same person. But I thought, oh, he is really released. He has really released. After sitting here for 2 years. We don't do this overnight. We don't make these changes overnight. But we do it. We do it. We can all do it. So, the Majjhima Nikaya, Pali scripture, the Sutta on Fear and Dread. Well, it's pretty simple. All Buddha says in this is that fear inevitably arises when you experience a sense of separateness from others or from the environment, and that when the sense of separation diminishes, fear starts to lose its grip. That's all he says. In many different ways, over and over again. There's a lot of redundancy. Well, now this is an oral transmitted tradition, so there's a lot of redundancy. But redundancy doesn't hurt when our minds are like they are. Just to hear this again, just to hear this again, just to hear this again. So Jethro also, when sitting with his frozen shoulders, wasn't, you know, not very pleasant. Not very pleasant. So he began doing bookends of loving kindness meditation. Beginning of his zazen, the first 5 minutes, and the last 5 minutes. And then because that would just soften him up, so he could just be with. And this is what he did. This is from my note from 20 years ago, or I don't know how many years ago. May I find freedom from fear in my life. May I also help others find freedom from fear. May I meet the fear with the courage of the open heart, acting with decisiveness rather than divisiveness. So this being with fear, this getting to know fear, this not judging fear but opening to it, accepting it with your heartfelt sense, is a way that we liberate happiness. We liberate happiness. That happiness that's in here gets liberated. But then we can also liberate happiness by focusing on happiness. By having bare awareness and curiosity when we have experienced happiness. So often we're so attached to the attitude of worry or depression that we no longer are present for our moments of happiness. We're no longer present for them. I'm not saying they're not there. We're just not present for them. We're so attached to our struggles and our disappointments that we don't celebrate and share our brighter moments, our bright moments. And this happens more often if there wasn't much joy in your family of origin. Now all of you are going to check into your family of origin. That's okay. You can check into it. Philip Moffat says there are three types of happiness. First is doing things we love. If we do things we love, if we really, really reflect on the things we love to do and do them periodically, it brings us happiness. Very, very simple. It seems so hard for us. We have these lists of things, and then doing the thing that I love is kind of number 13th on the list. Well, can we pull it up to number 1 on the list? Jeez. Can we have a little compassion for ourselves? Or maybe number 2 if it can't be number 1. Doing things we love. And the second one, a well-being that comes when our mind is joyful and at ease regardless of what's going on. And the third one is boundless joy, or boundlessness joy, boundaryless joy. So the first one, doing things we love. Easy delight. When conditions in your life are what you want, and we can do the things we love, or we create the conditions to do the things we love. A delightful moment with your child, or your friend, a quiet dinner with someone you have great affection for, being outdoors, doing cross-country skiing, whatever it is. It's important. It's important. So when I was in this warm place, I went swimming in the ocean every day. That's something I love. I've loved that since I was a little boy. Something I love. And right now I can't go swimming in the ocean every day. So here I am. Here I am. I could go swimming in the Y every day, but that ain't it for me. That ain't it. Fine to go swimming in the Y, but that's not doing something I love. So pay attention. Do more things you love. Life is short. Pull them up. Don't rationalize that you don't have time to do them, or they don't, you're da da da, whatever you rationalize. Don't believe it. It's just a stupid story that you're telling yourself. Even Eeyore, Winnie the Pooh, right? Even Eeyore, as much as he complained, he loved being with Pooh. He did what he loved every day, which is being with Pooh. Now, he may have complained the whole time, but he was doing something he loved. He was being with Pooh. So I had a friend who later was a student named Stan, and every time I had a one-to-one with him, he would end up complaining. He complained every time. And finally we got to the point where, and of course a lot of things he complained about was the Zen Center. You know, the way we were doing things, or the board of directors, or the this or that. And finally I said to him, well, you're always complaining. I wonder if there's any fear underneath that complaining. He seemed puzzled by that idea. But anybody who does repeated complaining is usually afraid. And that complaining is masking that fear. So, after a while, I just suggested he do a happiness log. And he said, I have nothing to say on the happiness log. But I kept at it, and he kept meeting with me, and then he started writing things down that he felt happy about, that he kind of overlooked, that were there all the time. They're all there all the time. So how do we respond to these moments of happiness, which we even often overlook or discount? How do we respond to them? Are we caught by the past or the future diluting the immediate experience of just doing what we love? Or are we able to just give ourselves to it? And if Eeyore could love being with Pooh, we can love. There's something all of us can love, regardless of how much of a funk we're in. We can give our heart to it, regardless of how much of a funk we're in. So let's say I'm having a conversation. When I was in this warm place, for two of the weeks, I got to be with my grandsons. That's another thing I love. But I especially love being with them when they're apart from each other. When they're together, I don't love it. I tolerate it. I try to manage it, although it's unmanageable. But I do not love it. Because they're like 8 and 12, and all they do is bicker. They bicker till they come to blows. They play. And then they bicker, and then they come to blows. And then they play, and then they bicker, and then they come to blows. Pretty much it. Pretty much the deal. So, Logan and I, the younger one, are having so much fun doing something together. He likes to do sports things, so I'm always doing sports things with him. Maybe we're kicking the ball. We're kicking the ball. But if I'm thinking to myself, when's Ethan going to be coming? Then I'm not aware of the potential for the happiness of this very moment, this kick. If I keep thinking, oh, there's Ethan over there, coming out from the backyard, then I'm not here with it. I'm not enjoying it. So that's where my bare awareness. Just, oh, I'm doing that. I'm doing that. I can come back to just being with Logan, just being with him, even though Ethan is going to come sooner or later. You know, right now, this is it. I can connect. I can connect. I can notice when I'm doing this, when I'm, instead of just enjoying kicking the ball with Logan, thinking, what's Ethan going to do this time? Ethan is nasty to Logan. Well, Logan's learned how to be nasty to Ethan, too. He's a pretty smart kid. Instead of saying, oh, you know, when's he going to come in? What's he going to do? I notice I'm saying that to myself. I breathe. And I come back to the kicking the ball, enjoying Logan. Simple. Zen practice is really simple. It's too simple for us. Too simple. That's why we have to go over and over again. Get reminders. Have reminders on our refrigerator, in our shoes. Wherever. Reminders, reminders. So the second kind of happiness. When something happens that's not so, that isn't good, and yet you're in a pretty calm state of mind, so that when you encounter this unpleasant person or unpleasant dog or bad situation, your state of mind doesn't get jarred. You just stay open and calm. Means your practice is improving, or your meditation practice is improving. You're realizing that these moments don't define you, and you can have a sense of well-being, a state of mind that stays. You can begin to notice when that happens through bare awareness and curiosity. So, for instance, let's say that I took my car into Parent's garage. That's a mechanic I used to use on 36th and Lindale. And I come in, I take it in for a little tiny thing, which is going to cost $150. And then I go to pick it up, and it's going to cost me $1,500. Anything like that ever happened to any of you guys? How did it get from 150 to 1,500? Well, possible that I'm still feeling pretty good. It's possible my state of mind is so sort of just open that's not getting me. Then I can bring awareness to that feeling of well-being and note its nature. Does my belly feel relaxed when I'm there at Parents for Garage and I'm not feeling pissed at the guy for telling me it's $1,500, but just feeling open? Oh, that's $1,500. I see what you did. Yes, you had to do this and that and that. Does my belly feel relaxed? Is my breathing free-flowing and unconstricted? And am I clinging to this feeling of centeredness, or am I... Is there an underlying sense of trust that no matter what I do, it'll be okay? Such ease exists, and it can be cultivated. And that's what we do in our practice. And we can appreciate this feeling the state of mind. When it comes, it may be rare, but when it comes, it's an opportunity to practice. And then you discover it's not as rare as you thought. And the third type of happiness is the one that everybody gets so excited about. That's enlightenment, an enlightenment experience, right? Satori, Kensho, enlightenment. I don't know if the Philip Kaplow book is still around. How many of you read the Philip Kaplow book? Oh, you want to read about enlightenment, you just read the Philip Kaplow book. You get all revved up, boy. It's a beautiful book. It's a beautiful book. So you fall into something deeper than your wants and desires, totally independent of your conditions, and also totally independent of state of mind. It's just here. And the Japanese call it mushin. No mind. No mind sounds negative. But anyway, that's what they call it. Boundarylessness. No longer identified with any one sticky idea or feeling or thought. Just part of this wonderful dance of life. This energetic dance of life. That's everything. And that kind of happiness could come out of the blue. It can come on a retreat. It can come in an accident, when you've had an accident or a life-threatening illness. It's nothing more than a spontaneous relaxation into what is. And if you're lucky enough to get that kind of taste of happiness, it gives you the sense of what's possible in your practice and can provide some faith and inspiration. Robert Aiken said, enlightenment is an accident, and practice makes you accident prone. Zen practice makes you accident prone. And the crucial component to all of this, both the fear practice and the happiness practice, is not clinging to the memory of, oh, I had that happiness time with Logan. Ethan wasn't around. If I cling to that, then I contaminate my ability just to be with Logan and just to be with Ethan. So not to cling to that memory. And that's liberating happiness. Not falling into the trap of wanting to sustain it by just wanting to do this with Logan forever and have his brother not be around. Or claim that I did something great, like I'm enlightened. I'm enlightened. You're not, but I am. But this enlightenment experience only happens when there's a complete falling away of little Tim who wants stuff. Complete falling away. Complete opening up to just this. So by doing these practices with both fear and happiness, we can move through fear and we can liberate happiness. Liberate our Buddha nature. Liberate it through bare awareness and curiosity. And it's helpful to work with a teacher. So come see me or see one of the other teachers here. Or do both. You don't have to deprive yourself of, oh, I can only do this much. You can do this much. Why not? Then your fears won't plague you so much, and your happiness quotient will rise, especially if you're not measuring it, if you're just doing the practice. If you're measuring it, it's going to go down. Well, then you're measuring it, let it go down for a while. Notice you're measuring it, and come back to just the practice, and it's naturally buoyant. So I'll end with a quote from Pir Vyat Khan, Sufi teacher. In the end, just three things matter: how well we have lived, how well we have loved, how well we have learned to let go. From joy, all beings have come, and to joy they all return. So I think that's what I want to say this morning. I'll be happy to have questions or comments or stories or songs? Yes.
I wasn't aware that you came from California.
You weren't aware that I came from California. I've only been here 45 years.
You know that he came from the same state that apparently I'm gathering around the same time. Did you know Diamond Kennedy Curry in California as well?
Yes. Oh. Yes. He was at my wedding in Palo Alto in 1966. And his wife was there too. He and his wife.
So there was a connection with him coming here and you coming here.
Well, it was an interesting coincidence. I didn't come here with him. I actually came here before him.
Oh. It was just
very mystical.
of all 52 states, you both came.
Very mystical.
Also, being a bit of a fan of pure culture, I'm going to have a little trouble remembering the exact words of an A.A. Milne or Winnie the Pooh quote. It was Christopher Robin that said this. If anybody else remembers this one, because it's a good one. Fear-based culture, as we all already know, keeps us from exhibiting or realizing or utilizing our potential. Inner fear, attachment, fear, etc. And you brought up Eeyore and Winnie the Pooh.
Yeah.
I have it on my bathroom mirror, and I know some of you know this one. I believe it was Pooh talking to Christopher Robin or the other way around. Promise me you'll always remember you are stronger than you seem, smarter than you think, and braver than you believe.
Cool. Wonderful. Thank you.
Does anybody know if I've got that right?
Sounds good. Carrie seems to know that you've got it right.
We'll bring in fear-based culture as well as more writing stuff that A. Milne came said. And speaking of fear-based culture, he wrote that book, those books, after coming back from fighting in World War One.
Really?
Talk about working your way through fear-based culture.
Wow. Thank you. Thank you, Chris. Yeah. What else this morning?
I appreciate your bringing in the body. Yeah.
Pardon?
I appreciate your bringing in the role of the body in working through fears.
Yeah. Do you want to say a little bit more about that, Susan?
Well, so oftentimes in Zen, you hear it said, all you have to do is see something and let go of it. Then you're liberated.
Yeah.
But there is, like you said, there is patterns and trauma stored in the body.
That's right.
So even after awakening, an initial awakening experience, you can still have the stuff that's in your body needing to be just, like you said, that rest and curiosity and...
Yeah.
Oh, I just appreciate that.
Oh, yeah. Well, thank you. Yes, I think it's really important. Could you guys hear her? They could. I think they're... Yes. Okay. Yes. Body-based practice is what we do. And many of these fears, anxieties are deeply lodged. They're deeply lodged. It's almost like they're cellular in nature, but they aren't. They're lodged in between our cells, so that they seem cellular. But this is what this is: body-based practice. Yeah.
I just want to share an observation I made that. When you mentioned Eeyore first, the energy in this room seemed to be at its peak for this hour. And I'm noticing energy because of Andrea Martin's and Kadagiri Roshi's new book.
Uh-huh.
And in that, she makes very clear this bubbling of energy in the universe is what we're looking for. It's just that simple and just that difficult. And so here's Eeyore bringing it. It's the Bodhisattva.
You are Bodhisattva. Okay. All right. I'm all for that. We'll put him on the altar.
Oh, yeah. But would he be happy?
That's okay. You gotta, That's okay. If he was there, lots of times, again, we don't know our own happiness because we're so hypnotized by this talk. But yeah, he'd be happy because he loves being with Pooh, and that means he loves being with us. Anything else? We do have a little time, so. But we could adjourn early if you would like. So I'm going to sit here for a minute and see if anybody else has something to bring up or ask. Yeah, Francie.
I really liked your example about playing with Logan and then how the mind goes to, oh, is Ethan going to come? And I think it's just such a good, we do that, I know I do that so much in so many ways, you know, in my life over and over, and that, you know, that is so much of what our practice gives us.
It's so much of what?
What our practice, this practice gives us, that opportunity to wake up and go, oh, that's just a fear coming.
Yes.
It's an image, that's just a mental formation. That's
yes.
Coming now and ruining
yes.
What we have.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
So,
uh-huh.
I love that.
Uh-huh. Sure. Good. You guys got the gist of what she was saying? Yeah. Okay. Well, anything more? Yeah, Carrie.
I'll say I appreciate this quote, and I think I'm going to copy it and put it, you know, on my wall.
Oh.
You know, when I get in that fear-based mentality, or, you know, things are coming up in my life that, you know, I have aversion to, or, you know, I'm overwhelming myself with tasks that I don't love, you know. How well have I lived?
Uh-huh.
How well have I loved?
Uh-huh.
How well have I learned to let go?
Uh-huh.
I really appreciate that. That's really all that's coming here in the end.
Uh-huh. I don't know this teacher. I just found this online. He must be a Sufi teacher. Pir Vyak Khan. Anybody know him?
I don't know. But very much reminds me of the end of Mary Oliver's poem in Blackwater Woods.
Oh, do you know that poem? Her poems are beautiful.
But it's about loss and life, and it'll come to me. Maybe someone else already knows it by heart. But it is about, in the end, what matters is loving what we love with all of our heart, with all of our depth, with all of our marrow, and then when time comes to let it go, let it go.
Uh-huh. Yes. I think that's the quote I tried to put in my second book, but we couldn't get permission, so it's being left out of my second book. I thought, well, gee, Mary Oliver didn't give us permission? Look at her poems. I would think she'd give us permission. Well, maybe it was some in-between person.
I think so. I think she was giving away her poems so freely
in
her career. And
oh, yeah.
Everyone loved them and used them. And I think somebody said,
somebody said, yeah. Okay, thank you.